We'll reconvene the meeting of the House Tax Committee. We're one member short of a quorum, but we're going to get started here. And then when we do have a quorum, there's a couple housekeeping issues we need to look at. What I've got is what we have today is a presentation on the study of the Metropolitan Area Fiscal Disparities Program, Department of Revenue, and Tischler Bice. Tischler Bice. Okay, very good. And members, please make sure in your packets that you are using the study of the Metropolitan Area Fiscal Disparities Program Executive Summary, February 13th, 2012, revised. There are some floating out around there that are not revised. We're working off the revised copy. So when we have a quorum, we will officially call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order. Representative Myra moves for reconsideration of the minutes dated February 8th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Wardlow moves that we change February 8th to February 9th. So delete 8 on the second line under minutes and insert 9. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The amendment is adopted. Representative Crawford moves to pass the amended minutes of amended to February 9th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Carlson moves the February 14th meetings. Any discussion? Hearing none. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Wasn't a whole lot of time to have discussion, was there? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved for February 14th. Now, what I'd like to do is we have a lot of material to go through today, and I'd like to turn it over to the presenters. And members, on this one, please hold questions until the end, and then we will hopefully have time for questions. We do have to vacate the room at 12 noon. So with that, if the folks at the witness table could please identify themselves for the record and start your presentation, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Eric Ouellette. I'm the policy director of property tax research at the Department of Revenue. With me is Julie Herlins from Tischler Bice and Carson Bice, president of Tischler Bice.
Okay, could you please, ma'am, could you please spell your last name for us?
Sure. It's Herlins, H-E-R-L-A-N-D-S.
Okay, Mr. Ouellette, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We'll be presenting the study that was mandated by the 2010 legislature to take a look at the fiscal disparities program and its impacts. By way of intro, I want to first acknowledge and apologize for the fact that there's a revised copy. We did discover after the publication of the original one that there were some data errors. They have been fixed, and again, I apologize for that. None of the findings came out differently, but some of the numbers changed a little bit. With that, I guess we'll just dive into the presentation.
Okay.
Thank you. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the committee, please.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. My name is Julie Herlands. I am a principal with Tischler Bice. I'm pleased to be with you here this morning doing a presentation on the study that we did on Metropolitan Area Fiscal Disparities Program.
Welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. By way of overview in terms of the presentation itself, we've taken care of introductions. I'll talk a little bit about what the study is, how we approached it, and what it's not. Look at the region. We're talking about the Twin Cities metropolitan area and some growth trends in the region. We'll look at tax-based trends, talk about the fiscal disparities program and recent trends over time, the impact of eliminating the fiscal disparities program. We've run some scenarios on this, and I'll talk more about this in detail. Also talk about the burden on residential homestead taxpayers and move to an evaluation of overburden. And I will talk in more detail about this in terms of the overburden, meaning are revenues generated off of different types of land uses sufficient to cover the costs generated by those land uses, and then talk briefly about policy considerations and areas for future research. just by way of further introduction in terms of our firm and where and our perspective, where we come from and what we do. We are fiscal, economic, and planning consultants. We merge the world of urban planning and municipal finance. The map shown on the screen are our clients, where we've worked nationally, not our offices. We're a small, very lean office based in the D.C. area, but we do work nationally, and we're one of the only firms nationally that focuses on what we call cost of growth services. What are the implications to local governments primarily of land use decisions? And part of that obviously is the tax policy and revenue structures in these different communities. We also do impact fees and infrastructure financing and revenue strategies. The majority of our clients, like I said, are local governments. About 90 to 95% of our clients are local governments. Occasionally we work on the private sector looking at impacts of development projects, but for the most part we do look at local government impacts, and so that this is the expertise in the area that we bring to this assignment. The study itself, what we did in terms of the study, so the fiscal disparities program takes 40% of commercial industrial tax base and puts it into a pool for redistribution. And I'll talk about one of the objectives of the studies, but one of the objectives was to, to promote more orderly development, to ensure that development happens in a manner that's good on a regional, that's beneficial on a regional scale as opposed to locally. And so one of the aspects that we looked at is to look at growth trends in the region, where has development occurred since the beginning of the program. So we have a timeline of from 1970 to today, where has population and employment growth happened. We also looked at fiscal and economic trends in the area. There's some detail in the report on, and I'll talk a little bit about this, about tax-based trends, where what has changed over time, and also economic, sort of more global economic trends in terms of income, per capita income, and looking at by county, and that's the details in the report. We don't get into that level of detail in the presentation. we're tasked with looking at the fiscal disparities program trends over time. And then in particular, as I mentioned, what would happen if the program were eliminated, and what would that mean in terms of tax rates and taxes paid in the various communities. The other key large part of the project is this analysis of overburden, and this is where our expertise in cost of growth services comes into play, about looking at, again, what are the revenues generated off of particularly non-residential types of development, commercial, industrial development. Are the revenues generated sufficient to cover the costs? And so, in particular, under the program, the fiscal disparities program in place, and then what would happen if the program were taken away, if it were eliminated? And then we also identify and discuss major policy considerations. So what we were not asked to do is to do a program evaluation of the program, nor asked for recommendation, nor were we asked for recommendations on the program. So this is really an analysis and data-driven type report, and so there are no recommendations here in the study. The region that we're looking at, so it's the Twin Cities region, there's over 180 cities and townships, over 60 school districts, and dozens of other taxing authorities. The program affects all levels of taxing authorities, cities, towns, schools, the county levels, as well as special districts, because it's a tax-based sharing program as opposed to revenue sharing. The fiscal disparities program covers seven counties, and what's interesting is that at the inception of the program, the way that the census defined the area was a five-county region. Today, the way the census identifies the metropolitan statistical area is 13 counties, two of which are in Wisconsin. But the program itself, the fiscal disparities program, just covers the seven counties, Anoka, Dakota, Anoka, Carver, Dakota, Hennepin, Ramsey, Scott, and Washington. We also looked at, did analyses throughout the study, grouping the municipalities into development types or regional development classifications. And these are Met Council designations or categories. looking at characteristics of the communities. So the groupings are central cities, of which there are two, St. Paul and Minneapolis, and then developed areas, developing rural growth centers, and rural areas. There's some additional ones shown here, and this is, you can see in more detail in the study itself. Our main categories are five groups, and to look at, you know, what are the impacts by type of community as opposed to just by the county breakdowns. So our first series of slides looking at growth trends, first we looked at population growth by county over time, and so we had some issues in the previous session about the legend, and I'll go through the colors and the color blocks. But first, what you're looking at is on the top bar is the population, the share of population by county in the region in 2010. The bottom bar is 1970, so the starting point in the bottom bar, 1970. And so the color blocks go the first blue, Anoka, Carver, Dakota in green, the large blue aqua color, Hennepin in the middle, Ramsey is orange, Scott is purple, and then Washington at the end in the light blue. And so the point here, while there's been significant population growth in the region over this 40-year period of almost a million people, the shares have shifted where the population is. So Hennepin and Ramsey counties, while still the most populous counties in the region, do comprise a smaller share of the regional population in 2010 as compared to 1970. So in 1970, the share of those two counties together, share of the regional population was 77%. In 2010, it's 58%. So almost, you know, approaching 80% versus 60%. Next, grouping these communities into the type of development, the type of communities. Again, the top bar is the population share in 2010, the bottom in 1970. And so looking at the color blocks, central cities are in blue, developed area is in the red, green developing areas, rural areas in the aqua, orange rural growth centers, and then a portion that's excluded from the fiscal disparities program. And in the full report, the first appendix in the full report, there is a complete list of all of the jurisdictions, all of the municipalities within in the seven county area and where they fall within those categories. So if you have a particular place in mind, you can go and look in that appendix for which type of category, which classification they fall into. And so the takeaway here is that for central cities, the share of the regional population has decreased from 40% in 1970 to about 23% in 2011. Developed and developing areas, the population share has increased from 57% in 1970 to 70% in 2010. And we looked at the location of the jobs, of the employment base, and so this is where the jobs are located as opposed to where the workers live. And so, again, top bar being 2010, the bottom 1970, and again, Anoka, going in order, Anoka, Carver, Dakota, Hennepin, Ramsey, Scott, and Washington in order. The Hennepin and Ramsey counties, while still containing the largest numbers of jobs in the absolute sense in the region, they have also declined regional share relative to other counties, decreasing from 89%, almost 90% in 1970 to 73% today. All other counties have gained in share, with the largest gain in Dakota County, increasing from 4% to 11% in 2010. Again, grouping them by development groups, types of regional development classification. Central cities in blue, developed areas in red, developing area, and then on down rural area, rural growth centers and excluded, central cities has declined from 56% to 30% from 1970 to 2010 in terms of regional share, and developed and developing areas have increased from 42% in 1970 to 67% in 2010. And this tracks with national trends overall in terms of dispersion of job growth outside of the core areas nationally. Next, we turn to trends in tax base in the metro area. And we have two slides, and this is grouped by the regional development classification. So looking at the types of communities, central cities, developed area, developing areas, rural growth centers, and rural areas. So this first slide shows the share of tax base within the region for residential homestead tax base. And so for residential homestead tax capacity, most areas have maintained the same approximate share of the regional total share from 1996 to 2011. And this time period is different than the previous slides. This is 1996 to 2011. And so the exception here is with developed areas and developing areas. Developed areas have seen a 9% decrease in regional share of residential homestead tax base, and developing areas at the opposite end has seen an increase of 6%. Looking at the same groupings of communities, but for the commercial industrial tax base, and this is before redistribution of fiscal disparities program, again, 1996 and 2011, central cities and developed areas have each lost 4% of their regional share, with developing areas gaining 8%. And again, this reinforces the development trends we've discussed earlier in the previous slides regarding outward growth of employment, and it's reflected also in tax base. The fiscal disparities program had six original objectives. They're shown here, also discussed in the report. And the objectives here were to provide a way for local governments to share in resources that may be generated in one area of the region without removing resources that that government already has at their disposal. To, as I noted earlier, to increase the likelihood of orderly urban development, that to reduce the influence or the impact of the locations of different businesses due to the occurrence of major infrastructure availability, and to establish incentives for the region to work as a whole, as opposed to competing locality to locality for commercial industrial tax base. It was also to help communities in different stages of development, so that areas that were developing would have resources available to them, while developed or areas that were on the decline would have resources available as well to make up the difference, and to encourage protection of the environment, so reducing the need to develop environmentally sensitive areas to get commercial industrial property tax base, so that those areas could be preserved and there would be some revenue, some assistance from other parts of the region. These six objectives have commonly been boiled down into two main goals or objectives: to promote more orderly regional development and improve equity in the distribution of fiscal resources. We should note here that in terms of the program, that it's tax base sharing, and all communities contribute their tax base, and all receive, but some contribute more than they receive and are then net contributors. Some contribute less than they receive and thus become net recipients, and that's the terminology that we use throughout this analysis. On page 15 of the executive summary and of the report itself, we have some graphics, visuals in terms of what has happened over time in terms of recipients and contributors, and particularly by groups of types of communities. So within the central cities have either all been recipients or split between recipients and contributors, and it's Minneapolis that's been either a net recipient or a contributor. St. Paul has consistently been a net recipient. Developed areas, those communities in the developed area category are almost evenly split between recipients and contributors, and this reflects a change from 1976, where there were almost twice as many recipients as contributors. The number of developing area communities has essentially remained constant over time from the inception of the program, 1976 to 2011. In 1976, when the program took effect, recipients in developing areas, recipients have outnumbered contributors at both points in time. Rural area communities have seen, I would say, the largest change in terms of numbers of recipients and contributors, where in 1976 there were five times as many recipients as there were contributors, and today that number has decreased to only three times the number of recipients as there are to contributors. And rural growth centers, those communities identified as rural growth centers, are all net recipients in 2011, and this is the same as it was in 1976. So a big part of the analysis, which was an analysis of looking at what are the averages of current rates totally, and this is page 18 and 19 of the executive summary, the full report on 96, page 96, 98, but I understand you have the executive summary, and this is where the revised version will have the updated numbers here for this piece of the study. So we looked at what are the average rates currently within, and again we've looked at this, we sliced and diced this in terms of looking at by counties, grouping it by counties, and also grouping by regional development classification. So this first slide is by county. And so looking at current average tax rate, and these rates include the municipality rate, the county rate, the school district rate, and the special district rate, and there are averages used on the special district rate and the school district rates as well. And then what the impact would be if the program were eliminated, what would that do to the tax rates? Again, looking at the top two slides, and also the bottom portion is what would it do to the impact on the what would the impact be on the taxes paid? There are two different tax rate analyses shown. One is weighted averages, and the other is the average of the jurisdiction rates. There are some differences there, but in terms of looking at doing a weighted average of all taxes paid in the tax base. The one point we wanted to make on this piece of the analysis is this assumes the same levy at each locality. And so those that would see a rate increase with the elimination of the program may not increase the rate to the full amount, may not levy the full amount because the burden would be too great in terms of the tax impact. But for this analysis, this is the extreme. Here is what it is today, and here's what the rate would be if it were eliminated and the levy stayed the same, the amount of revenue needs and the amount of revenue generated stayed the same. So the top portion, the takeaway here is that within Anoka County, there are two extremes. The largest tax rate increase percent on a percentage basis would be in Anoka County, excuse me, which would increase by 10.3%. and the tax rate in Hennepin County would decrease by 3%. We've also shown here, and again in we've shown here the metro average area average rate overall for all communities as a point of comparison, as well as the fiscal disparities area-wide rate, again, as a point of comparison. And so that's applied to that commercial industrial property pool. the bottom portion then shows taxes paid, and the taxes included here are, and it's what's property taxes, and it's at the city level, the county level, schools, special districts, the state, and the area, that portion that's paid on off of the area-wide rate as well. So again, the two outliers here, a decrease in the taxes paid would result in Hennepin County of 2.6% and an increase in Anoka County of 5.6%. Grouping the communities into their regional development classifications is shown here on this slide. And so the top portion is the tax rates and the changes to tax rates if the program are eliminated and the bottom portion is taxes paid. And so the outliers here in this case in terms of tax rate paid, the rural growth centers would see the largest percentage increase in their tax rates without the program at about 14.7%, and the lowest level of increase would be within the developed areas, less than 1%, less than half 1%. The taxes paid portion would increase again in the rural growth centers by the highest percentage, 10.5%, and within the developed area would decrease by 1.4%. And then finally, in this series of slides, looking at the groupings of communities in their, whether they're a net contributor or a net recipient in the fiscal disparities program, top portion showing that contributor communities overall would see an average decrease of 2.4% in their tax rate. Recipient communities would see an increase in their tax rates of about 8%. And the taxes paid would track in that manner as well. Contributor communities paying 3% less taxes overall, property taxes overall, and recipient communities paying 4.6% more in taxes. The next slide is not in the executive summary. This is pulled and done specifically for presentation purposes, and it pulls out, but it does reflect the results that are on the handout, which was provided separately in terms of the tax rate changes with and without the program, and this PowerPoint will be made available, and so you can see this in more detail. But what we wanted to do is to pull out the top two net contributors and net recipients by the dollar amount, not the change in tax rate, but by the absolute dollar amount in each county to see what would happen in terms of the tax rate. And so the green bar are the largest net contributors in each county. The orange bar figure is the largest net recipients in each county. And so within the net contributors, the two largest contributors within Hennepin County would both see a decrease in their rate overall. The other contributors in other counties, well, some would see a decrease, some would also see an increase, and this is a result of the county tax portion of the equation, where because all of the levels of taxing levels of government are affected, those contributor communities within recipient counties would experience an increase in their overall tax rate primarily because of the county piece, as well as the removal of the area-wide rate. Looking at the piece of the analysis we did on the residential homestead burden, so this was using the VOS database, which looks at the residential homestead tax as a percent of income, and this is median, dealing with median, so median income and median tax, again, over looking at the current law and removal and what would happen with removal of the program. Assuming elimination of the fiscal disparities program with no adjustment in levy amounts, median taxes paid would increase in all counties except Hennepin, where the decrease would be minor. As a percent of income, the homestead burden would fall for all property from 3.41% to 3.49%. The largest increases would be in Anoka County, and the decrease would be in Hennepin, a 0.02% decrease. Looking at the groupings of net contributors and net recipients, what's interesting here is that contributor communities, on average, in terms of the median impact, there would be no change in the burden in those communities, but there would be an impact in the burden in recipient communities, increasing from a 3.44% to a 3.6% percent of income.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to jump in here for just a minute, partly to give Julie a chance to take a drink of water. But
Mr. Ouellette.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the VOS, as Julie mentioned, these are median burdens. So the median homeowner in all of the cities that are in each of these counties. It's important to know, though, there's going to be a lot of variation there depending on the mix of communities. So one of the things that we'll talk about at the end about future research, it would be good to disaggregate this a little bit and look at the extremes because these numbers, the medians don't move very much, but there are going to be some individual jurisdictions where the homeowner changes up or down are going to be a lot more significant. So important to note that the averages are masking some bigger movement that's going to happen in particular communities. And also one other point that I would make, when you're thinking about the results of taking the fiscal disparities program away, what we show in the PowerPoint is total tax change, but there's going to be a decidedly different impact between the change for commercial industrial property that directly participates in the program and the impact on other types of property which change with the tax rate. So overall, commercial industrial property would benefit from the program going away, where homesteads overall would pay more. Both of those have exceptions to them depending on whether a community's particular circumstances, but one of the reasons why on this slide you don't see a lot of downward pressure or a lot of relief for homesteads is because when you take the program away, homestead taxes on the whole in the metro area are going to be going up 1.5%. CI is going to, commercial industrial taxes are going to be going down 2.5% on the whole. So this is part of the broader context to make sense of these numbers.
Mr. Lance.
Mr. Chairman, and to that point, the full report does show the residential and commercial, shows the impacts disaggregated into residential and commercial changes, what that would mean to a residential and commercial tax taxpayer. It's in the full report, the longer document. Thank you.
Mr. Lenz, what page are you on on the summary?
Okay, it's
25.
25.
In the for the residential commercial breakdown piece.
Is it this? Yes.
Oh, okay. This is.
It's 25.
I think we're on 25.
Yes.
Okay. Oh, okay. The font. Okay. Yes. Right, and this just goes into the evaluation of overburden piece of the study. Okay. Yes. Okay, so the last major research piece that I'll discuss and present is this question of overburden and evaluation of overburden. And so one of the points that came out in our as part of the charge for the study itself, the request, and also in discussions with stakeholders and community members, is this notion of does commercial industrial property generate enough revenue to cover the demands for the services and infrastructure that come off of that type of development? And this is where we do a lot of our work nationally, doing fiscal impact analysis, looking at direct revenues and costs to serve different types of land use, and what happens when you change patterns, what happens if you change types of development, what does that do in terms of the overall fiscal condition and picture for in most cases, a locality. And so what we did to answer this question, or to try to answer this question, or to begin the discussion of answering the question, I should say, is conducted a cost of what we call a cost of land use fiscal impact analysis for sample jurisdictions within the region. And so we looked at four different case examples representing different types of these categories: central city, developing area, developed, and rural. And we looked at this in two different ways under the current taxing system with fiscal disparities and then without it. What happens if you take away fiscal disparities? And so we adjusted the tax rates in those situations to maintain the levy. Again, we didn't make assumptions about any kind of levy back situation, but just maintaining that same amount of revenue to meet the needs as they are today, and what would the tax rate need to be, and then what would that do in terms of individual land uses generating revenues. The analysis is cash flow to the public sector, direct revenues and direct costs off of these different types of land uses to the local government. It's different from an economic impact analysis. A lot of times communities will do an economic impact analysis, which looks at, well, if you develop a, if you have a new headquarters office building, if you have a new, you know, a new shopping mall, what does it do in terms of the economic impacts, the overall impact to the economy in terms of new jobs created, spin-off development, spin-off revenues, you know, retail, other types of land uses popping up to support that industry. That's important. It's an important type of analysis to be done, but this is not that type of analysis. This, what we've done, is truly direct revenues, direct expenditures. There's no spin-off assumptions made in terms of additional revenues or costs that come out of the type of land use. The bottom line is looking at the question, are revenues enough to cover the service and facility demands and costs for each land use type? And if they are, it's a net surplus. If not, there's a net deficit. In this case, the net deficit indicating a potential overburden for that level of government for that type of land use. The cost of land use fiscal analysis is a truly a snapshot approach to determine direct costs and revenues. So we're looking at a point in time, current levels of service, current property values. We've used averages for property values of different types of land uses. And again, this question is, what type of development, does development pay for itself? If it does, what type pays for itself? And is there an overburden in terms of, on particular, the non-residential side of the development spectrum? Limitations in this type of analysis are that it does rely on average and average costing approach, so you get some averaging factors in terms of the service demands. And we do use prototypes, so we're looking at average market values and generating property taxes off of those values, where you may have extremes in different communities where a very high end, is going to have much different results than low end and the average. Again, we looked at two different scenarios, the current system and the hypothetical without the fiscal disparities. Again, adjusting the tax rates but in assuming the same levy. We do, in the fiscal disparities scenario, the first set of slides you'll see for each jurisdiction, for each set of communities, is where we do include fiscal disparities revenue coming back to the communities, and we use an approach to base it on the fiscal disparities formula itself. And so the key factors are market values and population. So in this case, so our land uses in our scenarios, in our analysis, are the residential land uses essentially get fiscal disparities revenue allocated to those types of land uses, because that's what's really driving the equation, the population and the market values within each community. And so there's a distinction between the two sets of scenarios. We don't, we also should know that we don't adjust other types of funding, particular state funding. So adjustments to the fiscal disparities program would affect LGA, the LGA formula, and other funds that come from other formula-driven approaches. But we kept that constant to see what would happen in terms of adjusting just fiscal disparities. But in reality, all of those other formula-driven aids would be affected as well. This slide is in here for the record. I'm going to use this as my notes, really, for the first set of slides. I should note that we have revenue generation for each type of land use and costs as well. And so there's a very detailed further appendix, separate document, Appendix F, which shows all of our methodologies and the factors that went into the fiscal analysis. We analyzed for each case study jurisdiction, three levels of government. So the impacts at the city level, the impacts at the county level, and the impacts at the school district level. And then we show here in this series of slides that I'll pull up the total net effect, combining all of those results. However, a net surplus in one jurisdiction at the city level, when there's potentially excess revenue for different types of land uses, would not offset a deficit or an overburden in another level of government at the county level, say. So we show it in total, and it really is more from the taxpayer perspective that you're paying taxes at these different levels. As a taxpayer for this particular land use, do your revenues cover in total your impact? But if you're looking at it from a city or county or school district perspective, your takeaway is going to be much different than a taxpayer's takeaway from those results. And you'll see here on the slides the data point piece. So in terms of what's a net surplus and what's a net deficit, and so it's easier to talk about showing on the screen. So what you're looking at here is, and these are all in the executive summary, starting on, this series starts on page 28. There's the graphics are shown on the same page, and then the following page shows the findings and the results. We show different types of land uses. So the left portion are single family. So the residentials were single family here, a multifamily and apartment, and then moving on to non-residential, retail, office, industrial, and institutional land uses. And the bars above the zero line, let me back up, the individual bars show the results for the levels of government. Orange is city, the county is blue, the green is school district results, and then the hatched bar is the total, combining all three results into one total impact. Again, from the taxpayer perspective, and then the bar lines above the zero line represent a net surplus. So in this case, not an overburden. Those lines that are lines that are below the zero, reflecting a net deficit, and in this case, potentially reflecting a net an overburden in this analysis. So this is a result for Central City. It's a recipient, and this is the analysis with under the current system with fiscal disparities program in place. So as shown on the residential side. A single-family unit of a high enough value will generate surpluses, net surpluses, not an overburden, to each local of government. The other types of residential development are either a net deficit, an overburden, or a slight net surplus. The looking at the non-residential, where I'll focus most of my attention on in the findings, from an overall perspective, there does not appear to be an overburden in terms of the results being in total a net surplus, so not an overburden with the exception of institutional land uses. However, looking at the results at the city level, retail development does not pay for itself and could be seen as an overburden. What would happen if we took the fiscal disparities program away? So for this community, what would the impacts be? On the residential side, there would be deficits. And so in this case, this community would see an increase in their tax rate to compensate for the removal of fiscal disparities. But they would also, in terms of the distribution of the fiscal disparities revenue, lose that revenue on the residential side. So the single family units of lower values would be affected, and those deficits would deepen. On the non-residential side, there would be a higher tax rate. Again, there's no levy back scenario. It's just to raise the rate to the point where you'd get the same amount of levy. So on the non-residential side, the retail, office, and industrial would those impacts would be better, would be higher net surpluses. However, on the city side, the retail would still show a net deficit, still not enough revenue generated directly from that type of land use to cover the costs associated with it. Now turning to the developed city in the analysis. So this is a developed city and a contributor in Hennepin County. And again, looking first with fiscal disparities and then without. So similar findings in terms of the non-residential impact. The residential is slightly different in terms of the deficits on the lower value units. On the non-residential side, in total, retail, office, and industrial showing that there isn't an overburden in total. However, again, looking at the city level specifically, that there are a city level on the retail side that revenues generated from retail development are not sufficient to cover the costs. And so taking away the fiscal disparities program, in this case, the tax rate would decrease, so there would be less direct revenues at all levels, at all in terms of the tax rate itself. So on the residential side, the deficits deepen, it's worsen. On the non-residential side, retail, again, in total, is a net surplus and not an overburden, but at the city level, again, without the program, showing a continued overburden to serve that type of development. Turning now to the developing city, again, first with fiscal disparities, and then we'll look at without. results are, again, similar on the residential side, a little bit of a mixed bag in terms of the median and average single-family home. On the non-residential side, the results change and do switch a bit, showing for particularly retail and office. So in total, on the retail side, in this particular community and in a developing community, the costs incurred for those types of development, both at the city and the county level, are not sufficient to cover the expenses, and in total is an overburden. The office essentially breaks even. Industrial is still a net positive and not an overburden. Without the program, on the non-residential side, the results do flip in total. Retail and office, industrial continues to be a net positive. Retail and office, not an overburden. But again, at the city level, which is the trend throughout, that retail development at the city level not generating sufficient revenues to cover its expenses, again, at the local level, at the city level. And then finally, on the rural, for our final example is a rural area example, which is a net contributor. And this tracks more with the developing area findings, both on the residential and non-residential side, where retail development at the city and county level not generating sufficient revenues to cover its expenses. Same with the office essentially breaking even in total. And removing the program ends up flipping the office results to indicate not that there's not an overburden. There wouldn't be an overburden without the program. More direct revenues generated off those land use types, but in retail in total, still a net deficit. The key findings from this piece of the analysis on the overburden question really does depend on the type of development, residential versus non-residential, and within non-residential, retail, office, industrial, institutional, and also then depends on the level of government. We've seen differing results from the city, county level, and school districts, obviously. I've noted before that the results really differ depending on the perspective of who's asking the question, which level of government the level of government's going to look at their individual results, and the taxpayer may look at the equation in total. In general, overall, residential and some types of non-residential development do reflect an overburden to their local governments, both under the current system and without fiscal disparities, but again, it varies by jurisdiction and by type of development. There appears to be more similarities and differences among the different classifications of municipalities that we've selected. With over 180 jurisdictions, the differences could be there could be greater differences doing this type of analysis for every single one of the jurisdictions in the metro area. And again, it's important to note that the scenarios do not reflect a levy back situation where you're going to change the amount of revenue needs, but the tax rate does increase or decrease accordingly. Some of the key policy considerations or issues that have come out, both through our research and through discussions with stakeholders and community members, this question about overburden that has been brought up in the past about including a spending or needs component in the fiscal disparities formula. And so as we've found and see and through our experience nationally as well, that really this issue depends on the type of property, the level of government you're talking about, and the local situation in terms of levels of service. Communities vary within a region, nationally, in terms of their levels of service, how many acres of parks do you provide, what's your response time for police services, and thresholds vary widely nationally for those levels of service. It's important to note that in terms of the needs component, that one of the points brought up through some of our discussions is that the school funding formula has changed over time, that at one point in time it was locally, predominantly locally driven, and now is predominantly state funded. And so that needs component of the formula has changed in terms of local funding at the school district level. And finally, in terms of the overburden piece, that the local government aid and county program aid, they both do include a needs component in the formula, and the fiscal disparities program does not. And so that was just an important takeaway for our purposes in terms of, has this been done before, and is there precedent in terms of adding a needs component in there. It's important to remember that the program equalizes tax base and tax rates, and especially in particular in the non-rural parts of the metro area. Some of the impacts would be that without it, rural area rates would increase and would approach, move toward the metro average, increase toward the metro average, and rural growth centers would also increase but are already higher than the metro average. The question of the effect on business location decisions, the executive summary and the full report has some discussion about this and some literature, literature review in terms of what has happened nationally. There has been population and employment migration out of the metro core in the Twin Cities area, but this has happened elsewhere in the United States as well. So the question then becomes, well, without the program, would this be further exacerbated, or would there be a different impact? Without the program overall, more jurisdictions would see an increase in tax rates rather than a decrease. But without the program, jurisdictions that would see decreases in tax rates have primarily been the job growth centers already. And that it's also important to remember that the fiscal disparities program works within the system of revenue structures, aids, and policies, and changes to this piece of the revenue pie picture would have a ripple effect through the other programs and aid formulas. Finally, for areas of future research, the question that has come up both in discussions and through our research and our thinking about this is, does it make sense for localities to pursue commercial and industrial development? And if so, does it make sense to offer incentives? And then if so, what level? The answers will vary by jurisdiction, and in each particular situation, is there infrastructure already available? Do you have capital improvement needs and large expenses that another jurisdiction might not? Are there economies of scale where if you're going to add an infill, you're going to infill development, can you more readily accommodate those service demands? Will you be made whole or make money off of the project? And it really does depend on the jurisdiction and the specific situation. If the key issue or the question to answer is to address is business location decisions and competition among and between localities, then an area for future research could be conducting specific local research, localized research on tax rate effect. What's the effect of changes in tax rate? There's a lot of there's anecdotal research and or anecdotal discussion on that and the role that that plays. But there are a whole host of business location site selection criteria that are employed in those kinds of situations in terms of business location, and it does depend on the type of industry and depends on the lots of factors in terms of the type of business looking to select a site. And then finally, Eric mentioned the homestead burden analysis, and so the current analysis is really is looking at the median, and there is value in looking at the extremes and what that would mean in terms of the high end and the low end in terms of homestead burden analysis. And with that, that concludes my presentation. I thank you for your time.
Well, thank you very much. And members, what we'll do now is we will get into questions. I have a list here. And if we could direct questions, not so much amongst members, but directly on Mr. Ouellette and Ms. Herlands, because this is it. This is where we have you today, and we want to be able to direct our questions at you. Okay. I've got, and maybe I'll talk offline with somebody, because I know there's a lot of folks more in the metro area here that this really got a lot more questions than I probably do. But we went from five counties. We used to look at five counties. Then we went to seven. Now we're looking at 13, two in Wisconsin. Was there just, if we could talk to me later, something, I mean, is there any movement at all for fiscal disparities that you're aware of to broaden it to 11 counties and maybe send somebody to those other two counties in Wisconsin? Or let's back up before. If we could back up just a little bit here. I believe this law was passed in 1971. And members, I just want you to realize how important this issue is, because if you'll notice, it started in 1971, and I can't imagine what the tax committee debates must have been like then. I mean, it just must have been unreal. And you, Representative Carlson, you weren't here yet. You came in 70.
Came a year later.
Two years later. But this is very serious stuff, members, because you have to realize that the people who took those votes in 1971, none of them are here now. So it was that controversial that they're. it was a big bill. It was a big issue at the time. So we have to think about those things. Okay. So with that. But just think about that, what the debates must have been like back then. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is probably more of a comment than a question, but I did want to highlight, because I know our speakers went through things really quickly, and I did this in property taxes too, but the goals of the program were to facilitate, you know, orderly growth. And back then, they were optimistic people. Maybe we are today too, but we experienced some shifts over the 40 years since then. And I think the thought was that everything was going to grow and everybody was going to do well. And so how could we share that? You know, they were afraid that somebody might leapfrog ahead with the second airport and become another Bloomington. Or I think I had heard even that somebody thought the new Minnesota Zoo was going to turn us into Orlando. It didn't quite happen that way. I think that was the concept. And I think that it's important to note that, and if you look on pages 4 and 5, it's kind of highlighted that it didn't result in growth everywhere, and that what you see is that the central cities and the developed areas, which would be primarily the inner ring suburbs, actually lost both population and jobs in the over that 40-year period, while the collar areas, you know, just had boom times in terms of both population and jobs. And this wasn't the only contributing factor, but it really does say we should, as we examine this, look again at what we need to do in terms of redevelopment and revitalizing things, because it really isn't all about growth. And that was, I think, one of the assumptions when this was put together. And so as a result, we've got, you know, a whole different sort of efforts. And I did point out again, and I always think it's good to highlight our tax staff's work, and that when I was reading through this, I found the one sentence that I thought best crystallized this program, and I highlighted it. And then I looked at the footnote, and it says from Hines and Baker, a 2005 report. And that's on page 13, because I know it's hard to absorb all this tax base sharing. But it just says taxpayers and jurisdictions contributing more than they receive, the net contributors, pay more than their jurisdictions levy. And those receiving more than they contribute, the next recipients, pay less. And I think that's why this has always been a controversial sort of issue. It's because the taxpayers in some communities are paying more than their city, their county, and their school district combined levied, because they have to also contribute into this pool. And then the pool gets reallocated, and then somebody else pays less than what their city, their county, and their school district combined levied. And so that's why it's tax-based sharing. And the biggest efforts are on the counties, because the county is the biggest part of everybody's property tax bill almost uniformly. There's a few exceptions. And so if you look at it just at your city, you may not understand what's really happening for your taxpayers. And if you look at the county level, there's some pretty dramatic shifting. Hennepin County gives up $65 million of tax base, and Anoka County gains $25 million of that. And, you know, so it's a massive amount of money that's transferring. And, you know, given that Anoka County won the race last year to be the lowest tax levy, they dropped their levy 6.6%. You know, it does have consequences. And when we start shifting this around, and I think the findings are kind of cloudy, but I do think we need to take this seriously, because it's hundreds of millions of dollars that are shifting back and forth from each individual taxpayer as they write out their checks. It influences that total bill.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Representative Lesch, Hortman, Runbeck, Loon, Carlson, and Chesky. Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wasn't going to comment on Representative Loeffler's comments, but the time when Anoka County has the tax base to build a twin stadium, then maybe I'll take your comments more to heart. But there is more to be said about this than simply, well, you did. Hennepin County built a twin stadium with those sales tax dollars. So, I think this is something to examine, not just who's getting what and who's getting shortchanged. The vision of those in 1971 was, what are the implications for everyone going their own, despite the fact that we have a unique metro area, because we've got two core cities and we've got suburbs growing up around it. And so what happens when everyone just builds their own development and ignores it at the expense of everyone else? Well, then it costs everyone a lot more. So I think that was the vision. Ironically, it's really difficult to measure, because this program started in the midst, essentially, of the development of the interstate highway system and corollary developments off that in the metro area, which has changed our region more than almost anything. So, for example, in 1971, we were still 13 years shy of 35E actually coming through St. Paul, because that was stopped by a federal court action, ultimately, that led to a federal consent decree, which is why you all have to drive slower on 35E. But it didn't go through until the mid-80s, and so how can you really measure the development, commercial industrial development, and impacts of that? I'm wondering, though, for the testifiers, Mr. Chair, my question is, how is it that you can look at this when, in St. Paul, I'm always conscious of, you know, a third of our tax base, or 30%, is off the rolls. I think we have more universities than any municipality in the nation, except for Boston, and with all our government buildings, that takes even more off the tax rolls. And so I'm always conscious of that and trying to I'm happy that we have these universities in St. Paul, and I think it's great that we're a city that can educate students from all over the region, from other areas, and other cities that pay lower property taxes. I still think it's great, but and I'm glad to be the seat of government where we can provide those services for the region and the state as well, but there are some costs to that. I'm wondering, for the testifiers, was there any way that was taken into consideration, those type of factors, in your study? And if not, What's the best graph for me to look at as a St. Paul guy of how do I decide the impact that we take because of that missing tax base?
Ms. Herland?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Couple answers in terms of the impact on specific jurisdictions and St. Paul in particular. And so a lot of the analysis, as you saw, was rolled up to either the county level or the group by designation. St. Paul does fall in the central cities category, and so some of those results, you can glean from there. But we do have in the handout specifically each jurisdiction, the current rates that are paid at the county, municipal, and school and special district rate under the current program and then without it. And so for the city of St. Paul, the current rate on average is 128.87%, which is higher than the metro average currently at 113 and change. Without the program, the rate would increase to 141%. That would be a 12% increase in the rate itself, in the rate overall, all jurisdictions combined. So the tax rate would increase by a factor of, by 12 percentage points. That reflects one of the higher percentage increases. They are the largest city. St. Paul's the largest net recipient.
Well, if I can just follow up, Mr. Chair. Sure. So my question is this: the reason for this tax base shifting is because of shared resources, and so I'm trying to figure out. I can measure in St. Paul that our shared resources are because we've got universities where we're educating the children of the region, and we've got government buildings that are serving the people of the region and the state. So I understand that why we have a loss of tax base because of that. But I is there a way to extrapolate that impact specifically related to, say, if we didn't have the capital here, if we had an office building that was paying property taxes, mm-hmm. or universities were developed? Is there a way to extrapolate from that from the study, and for other municipalities or counties, the causes of their shortage of tax base? How would I go about examining that?
Mr. Lands?
Mr. Chairman, you're going to make a point about the fiscal.
Mr. Willett?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lesch, one of the things that might be helpful is when you look at those case study graphs, the last set of graphs on the very end that are called institutional land uses, that's a way to sort of quantify what that negative impact of the universities and other tax-exempt properties might be. It's going to be different in every community, and obviously your community has a lot of those, but it's consistent throughout the case studies. The case studies confirm what you're saying about the sort of net drain on the government sort of cost benefit from those types of land uses. But keep in mind, at least from the municipal perspective, the retail is consistently a net loss for municipalities, although for taxpayers overall, they generally end up positive in the case studies. So depending on what you would, in your theoretical, eliminate a university, replace it with something else, it kind of depends on what that something else is. And you look at the different land use types, and you can see, some are going to be a net gain to the community in terms of the revenues they bring and the costs they bring. Others are not going to be as good of a deal. So that's the sort of thing that the local governments have to grapple with when they decide, we've got this redevelopment we're going to do, or this new land we're going to develop, depending on the city. What are our options? And obviously, when you look across the case studies, you see that some options from a government budget perspective are better than others, although there's other reasons you want these kind of facilities.
Mr. Lamb?
If I may, Mr. Chairman, to piggyback on that last point that Mr. Willett was making about, swapping out different types of land uses, but, this really is looking at the direct impact, the direct revenues and direct costs, and not taking into consideration the economic impact and the economic value or otherwise of those types of land uses. And so you get lots of spin-off benefits from a university development that do end up trickling down into fiscal impacts, you know, more revenues generated locally potentially if it's in the right place and in the right community with others, you know, so supporting development would pop up around there. But this really is, you know, part of the equation, the fiscal impact to those levels of government. Institutional is not going to pay its way, but then layering on the potential economic impacts off of particularly universities, and there's lots of studies out there for economic impact analysis of universities and the benefits they bring to communities.
Representative Lash?
No. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hartman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You talked about the different impact in the counties, but we didn't really do a discussion of the cities and the different impact in the cities within a county. And I noticed in a county like Hennepin, where overall the median tax burden would decrease, in certain cities that's certainly not the case. And I'm wondering if you can talk about the characteristics of the different cities in Hennepin County that would see rather large tax increases if the program would go away, compared to the cities that would pay less in taxes. It looks like Brooklyn Center, Brooklyn Park, Crystal, Robbinsdale, St. Anthony get hit pretty hard. And what is the different characteristic of the tax bases in those communities that would make them pay more if the program were to go away compared to the cities like Bloomington and that would do quite well if it went away?
Mr. Lance or Mr. Ouellette?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Ouellette? Mr. Chair, Representative Hartman, within Hennepin County, there are communities that are net recipients from the program and communities that are net contributors to the program. Every community contributes 40% of its growth in commercial tax base since 1971 into the program. But the way it's distributed, the way that tax base is distributed back out is based on total equalized market value per capita. So the communities that you pointed out are generally the ones that have lower market values in Hennepin County. So they as cities are actually getting more tax base back than they're contributing to the pool. So when the program goes away, they lose that tax base from the pool and are left just with their smaller local tax base. So to raise the same amount of revenue, their tax rates have to go up and the taxes on all the property in those communities increases.
Representative Hartman?
So it's based on the market value per capita in those cities?
Mr. Ouellette?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hartman, yeah, the amount of tax base you get out of the pool is based on your relative overall property wealth per capita compared to all the other cities in the metro area.
Thank you.
Representative Runbeck?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think members, just as Ramsey County has characteristics that make it qualify it to be a contributor or a recipient, I think Anoka County does also, and we'll kind of hear about that. So I think it's still important to keep in mind the one big region that we are. And I don't know who made the comment about levy increase, decrease, what have you in Anoka, but I think it should be noted that that's all about finding county commissioners who have the will to cut levies. So thanks to Anoka County. But I did have a question about retail. And what is it in the analysis? Is it the cost that you impute to retail with respect to police services and so on that inherently make it okay?
Mr. Lance?
Too costly. Mr. Chairman, Representative, the primary drivers on the retail side are police costs and road costs. And so for retail development, you're going to get more vehicle trips attracted to that type of development. And so road costs are going to go up, and also in modeling police costs, we do use vehicle trips, because if you think about a retail establishment, the real impact from a police and fire public safety perspective is through the traffic, the people traffic, not necessarily just the jobs, the people that work there. So you could have a 7-Eleven with three people that work there at any given time, but you're going to have many trips during the day with folks coming in that are going to impact your public safety needs, so through shoplifting or medical emergencies, and also the impact on the roads that are serving that that development.
Chair Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think for Ms. Hedlunds or whoever would like to address, but Representative Runbeck hit on one of the questions that I was going to key in with regards to retail. And I know the legislation, I authored the legislation to provide the study, and my original bill did ask for recommendations, and apparently when I authored the legislation to provide the study, and my original bill did ask for recommendations, and apparently when this got through the final process, that was taken out at some point along the line, which I will find out about at some point later. But anyway, I wonder, because of the work that your firm does, and that if you could respond to these questions with regards to some considerations and from your work on development in that, if other areas have looked at this or what might make sense for the committee to consider. But one is that, you know, when looking at retail and the cost to the municipalities of retail, certainly the fiscal disparities program does not distinguish on commercial and industrial properties. You know, retail pays like everybody else, but yet the cost to those cities, including the net contributors, you know, they may bear a higher price for having those types of properties in their city, certainly. So, I mean, would that be a potential recommendation to look at either eliminating or adjusting for retail as commercial and industrial property in cities as part of this pool and this distribution?
Ms. Herlands, to the Loon question, I find it interesting that somewhere along the line that dropped, that the recommendations, I was just wondering, what would your firm charge to make recommendations, and would you really want to do it?
The boss just left, so I'm
that's not a good sign. It's a balloon question. Just her last.
Yeah. What would it cost? Anyway.
But the price just went up.
Yeah. Let me provide some context in terms of the fiscal disparities program. This is the only place in the country that has this type of a program at this level and this scale. There are tax-based sharing and tax-based sharing programs in other places on a much smaller scale. There's tax revenue sharing programs for specific purposes. I'm not an authority. It's not a comprehensive index in my head in terms of who does what and where. But there's obviously lots of revenue sharing that happens from the state levels, you know, down through, you know, nationally. So the sharing part is not unique, but the fiscal disparities program in and of itself, the way it's structured, the way it's been done, the long-term nature, I mean, this is one of a kind. That said, so in terms of other experiences in other places with retail, you know, or with different types of land uses, and do they cover their costs, and what's the mitigation? A lot of times what happens, and again, it really does come back to the locality and the revenue structure. So in places that have sales tax, local sales tax, that's point of sales driven, and that comes back to the locality, retail a lot of times will pay for itself. So you have property values and retail sales tax that's going to pay for itself. In places that don't have local, point of sales tax that stay locally, it tends to not because of the cost structure, because of the cost implications. So there's that piece. Other mitigation tools, and I mentioned we do a lot of impact fee work. So impact fees are one-time charges on new development to cover capital costs, cover infrastructure costs. So a lot of times communities will look to these sort of other sources of revenue and other financing mechanisms to cover those costs, to cover those shortfalls, and particularly on a lot of times on the non-residential side and on the road side, that you have these needs for new roads or improved roads and additional capacity. And so there, what can you do? You can have new development pay their fair share of those costs, not the total cost, but their fair share of what their impact is. So there are local solutions in terms of the mitigation, but overall on the formula side of the equation, I mean, that would be a big undertaking, and I would say primarily because of the numbers of jurisdictions that are affected and the conditions.
Representative Bloom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry, Mr. Lands, I can't see you. I'm talking around. Okay, thank you. All right, thank you. And that's important to note. And Representative Lincheski and I were just nodding back and forth that, you know, most of our, we happen to represent two major significant contributors in this. But the point is sales taxes that you referenced don't don't exist in our locations. They do exist in some rural areas of our state and also in our central cities, but not in our communities, which have a significant amount of retail. And then just, I guess, a little more broadly, you know, one of the objectives of the program was created was to kind of, what I assume was to encourage sort of smart development, if you would, to consider, you know, placement of parks and other things so that communities didn't engage in, you know, bidding wars really to entice businesses to come in, and it didn't disadvantage cities and areas that couldn't do that. But, in you know, several years later, is it possible that the program is actually having the opposite effect? I mean, if communities are largely being rewarded through the program, in which if they don't have any commercial industrial, if their bedroom communities significantly outside of employment centers and that, I mean, is this encouraging sprawl and sort of less smart urban planning?
Mr. Lance?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bloom, that's an excellent question. We've had lots of discussions internally and externally about those issues and the effect and not having an effect. You know, did it have an effect? And so there's a few points about one of the things that have come up about development patterns about is there. Does that provide a way to do just what you're saying for communities to focus on residential development and not encourage commercial industrial development? Is that necessarily a bad or good thing? I would say it depends on the location. You know, should the region have job growth that continues to move outward? And it has, even with the program. So without the program, if it hadn't been in place, which is the same effect, the same trends have happened elsewhere in the country, would it have been worse or would it have been different? And this is kind of taking out the St. Paul situation because that's a unique piece of the puzzle because that is part of the core. And so there are real impacts there taking away the program. But the question is, well, if you take away the program and tax rates increase in areas that are, you know, in the outlying areas, does that then encourage a type of development pattern that you're referring to of more focused inward where the rates would potentially be lower? And this is, you know, again, this potential for future research really focusing on the tax rate effect and you can model it. It becomes more difficult at the localized level because it does is more of, you know, the first pass at a site selection is really, you know, looking at the overall tax structure as opposed to individual, you know, local level. I reference in the report the Itasca project report and really their discussion was at a much higher level, you know, the state tax structure first and foremost, and then a decision about a location decision at that level first before you even come into the region and then looking locally. So, you know, it's very layered, obviously, and there's lots of complexities. But I do think, you know, all of these, that question and the point about the choices about development types and what you're going to what localities have incentivized or not incentivized, it comes into play, and fiscal disparities obviously has had a role in that, but to undo all of the other elements and features that would go into the equation of a development decision is impossible, I would say, at this point in time.
Representative Bloom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one final, because I know there's a number of members on the list. If you were to create a program like this from scratch, does it make sense to base it strictly on commercial industrial properties in various areas and not take into consideration necessarily the needs of communities as this redistribution occurs? I mean, we've got other programs, local government aid and that look at different characteristics of cities, but fiscal disparities doesn't do that. And, you know, there have been a couple of newspaper articles in advance of this hearing talking about the study and the look and some areas with pretty wealthy residential, you know, property values that are net recipients. And some comments have been, well, we don't, you know, we don't make the rules, we just abide by the game. So, and I'm paraphrasing, putting words in the mouth of that story, but saying that they don't necessarily need it, but they get it just because that's the way the formula works. So if you were going to create this, would you look at those other factors in as a more thoughtful program?
Mr. Lance, and then the second question is, who would carry that bill? Mr. Lance, to the Loon question.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Loon, I were to create this program. This is my own personal, you know, background, not the company and not the study, but I've been sort of a watcher and involved with sort of regionalization initiatives and the importance of looking at a region as opposed to localities. And this is getting even more important, and there's lots of research and studies coming out now about, you know, mega regions. I don't even know what the new word is now, but it was megalopolis, and now it's something, you know, megapolitan. I don't, you know, land use and spending decisions are made locally, but economies are regional. And looking at, you know, in this case, the drivers of economic development on the commercial industrial side. I mean, I can see why, and I can see the innovativeness of the program. The byproduct or the potentially unintended consequences of communities that then can either choose to just develop on from a residential standpoint, again, may or may not be beneficial to the region, because you may not want heavy commercial industrial uses in some of these areas that increases the cost, that spreads the cost, you know, to locations that shouldn't, you know, either shouldn't have it or don't have the access, or you're building new access, you know, major infrastructure to accommodate that. In other cases, maybe it does make sense where you want to have jobs closer to where people now live to reduce commute time. So there are lots of factors that go into play. The answer to the question of, you know, if to create it from scratch, I would defer to Steve Hines on that. And
Mr. Hines, I'll be visiting with you later. Thank you.
Okay, I have on the list Carlson Lencheski, Deputy Loeffler. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. By the way, you referenced whether or not I was here in 71. I was here the very next legislative session, and this issue was, that debate you were talking about, carried over. And I was a member of the tax committee when I came in 73, so carried over. And Charlie Weaver Sr. was on the tax committee, and as one of our handouts pointed out, was the chief author. But that's not where I was headed. I think the discussion on this has to, in part, talk a little bit about the service that a given community is provided. And I'm going to use Robbinsdale as an example. It's one of the four cities that I represent in total or in part. And Robbinsdale was a fully developed city prior to 1971. It was developed residential. There's virtually no industrial. There's a little bit of commercial along Highway 81 and West Broadway, and it's mainly kind of small ma-and-pa type stores, you know, the old-fashioned local hardware store and so on and so forth. But our largest employer, and I'm just kind of picking up of some of what Representative Lesh was pointing out, happens to be a very large nonprofit hospital, North Memorial. You read about it a lot in the paper, people being flown in from around the state. It services North Minneapolis, which it's right on the Minneapolis-Robbinsdale line, and it's the only hospital in that whole region. And that does create a municipal overburden for the city of Robbinsdale in terms of providing police protection and any number of things with that large hospital there. And so I was just going to comment that It's a big employer, about 6,000 people, the vast majority of them on the Robbinsdale campus. That's nice to have that large employer in the area. But in terms of tax base, it doesn't provide much to offset some of those costs that the city incurs providing a major regional center. And I don't know if you want to comment on the service aspect, but that's something that I've always considered as a part of fiscal disparities and meeting those kinds of broader community needs. And by the way, Robbinsdale is a city of about 14,000. And going back to Representative Lesh's point about percentage of property that would be off the tax rolls with that large hospital complex, I don't know if it would rival St. Paul as a percentage or not, but it would be a very big percentage of the city of Robbinsdale's potential tax base if it were on the tax base.
Ms. Herlands.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, this is a one of the key points or objectives of the program was to compensate for those communities that have large portion of their tax base that are off the tax rolls, and you do see that in the findings that if you were to take the program away, and I just pulled up Robbinsdale, and that you would see, you know, an increase in the tax rate, and that's likely why, because you have your land that could be developed for taxable commercial and industrial is non-taxable currently, and so you're not getting the benefit off of tax revenues directly, you know, locally from that structure. However, you are getting the benefit from an economic standpoint in terms of the numbers of jobs, local jobs, and the spin-off effect into the community, whether it's within your borders or just adjacent. So there is that economic benefit from that land use.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, by the way, most of those employees, however, do not reside in the city of Robbinsdale. Fairly good number do, but there is that advantage. I recognize that. But I just wanted to point out, Robbinsdale goes back almost as early as St. Anthony is part of Minneapolis that grew into Minneapolis. Very old city, and it was just developed prior to 1971. But that was the point I wanted to make. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative Carlson. Representative Lincheski, Deputy Loeffler. Representative Lincheski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I want to read into the record a note I got when I sat down that says, Representative Lincheski, thank you to the City of Bloomington for fiscal disparities from the recipient cities. So I'm going to frame this. and many of you know I've said repeatedly, it'd be nice if they just send me a thank you. But even better now, even better,
is it time?
I got another note. Well, this was in property taxes. So I came in here and I got another note that says, Dear Representative Lincheski, I would like to thank you for your constituents' tremendous generosity with their money to the rest of the state. And that's key because all of rural Minnesota is benefiting from this program as well. Your humble tax chair, Representative Davids. I really wanted to get that on the tape, and you know, I've been hurrying trying to write the you're welcomes, but there's about 850 cities that are beneficiaries because of people like Representative Loon's constituents and Downey's and others here at the table. And you know, I do really just want to say, you know, a couple things about this and ask a question. And first, I do want to thank Representative Loon. Really, it has been her leadership. When I was a tax chair, you know, I couldn't get my side of the aisle to even look at this thing because it was rough until my very last year, Mr. Chair. And as the tax chair in 2010, I put in the omnibus bill Representative Loon's bill, and that's why we're looking at it here today. This is just a huge success for the contributor cities to even get to talk about it, for goodness sake. So nothing's changing. This is just a study, the first ever since the inception of the program. So I do want to thank Representative Loon. And as uncomfortable as it is for some of the people on my side of the aisle, you know, this is at its core a wealth redistribution program, pure and simple. It is pejoratively socialism, or if you want to put a nicer spin on it, it's we're all one state, you know. So both sides of the aisle know how to talk about this. But this is just, it's just like LGA. It's taking from one and giving to another. And so, you know, I do think the contributor cities do like to at least, you know, think about this a little bit. And this study helps, and Representative Loon, I'm not sure. I may have been the one who took those recommendations out. I'm going to ask Mr. Michael later, too, so I don't know why we didn't get to that. But had we asked the people who are studying to give us recommendations, I don't know how much that would have changed anything, because in the end, it's up to us. You know, do we have the courage to actually change this program at all? And, you know, I will tell you, just sitting around the table, This program is bigger than LGA members and what it gives every year. It's bigger than LGA, and it's massive. So just looking at the in the room, Representative Myra has Burnsville Center, and Representative Downey has Southdale, and Representative Loon has Eden Prairie, and I have the Mall of America, and Representative Dabney, Loeffler, Lesh, and Paymar have some downtown retail facilities. And then there's other members who aren't here, like Representative Benson, who has Ridgedale. You know, just think about that for a minute. What does this study show? This is key. It shows that retail doesn't pay for itself. Retail is a net loser. And for all of us who are holding these big facilities, and I'm not talking about your typical Targets, Walmarts, Home Depots, Best Buys that everybody's got, we're losing. We are getting a bad deal here. You know, Southdale does not pay for itself. The constituents of Edina are paying for that so everyone else can go to Southdale. Now, you can say, well, you know, that's true in St. Paul or Minneapolis. But you know what Minneapolis and St. Paul have? They get LGA. They get a local option sales tax to make up for that overburden. And, you know, they get a number of other things. And then, of course, the sweetheart deal of all time, everything that was built before 1971 is grandfathered, so that doesn't go into the formula. So, you know, you go out in rural Minnesota and all the greater areas, St. Cloud, Moorhead, they all get a bump in the LGA formula to recognize they have overburdens. And part of the thing I think that Representative Loon was trying to get at is in this overburden issue, you know, those of us in fiscal disparities who have these large regional facilities, we don't get any bump in the formula. And now we find out in the report, retail doesn't pay for itself. Our constituents and the other businesses are paying for it. So, I mean, I do think that is one thing that the committee could honestly address is retail, Mr. Chair. And, Mr. Chair, I will tell you because you're carrying a TIF bill for the Mall of America, that's adding insult to injury. First of all, they don't pay anything. And then, nope, well, let's give them more subsidies. So we can talk about that a different day. But
I'm sure we will.
I'm sure we will. But, you know, members, you know, most people in this committee are not a big fan of picking winners and losers. But yet this is exactly what this does. Those of us who carry large retail facilities, we're losers in this game, big time, and everybody else is a winner. So, you know, I was just looking at it. Scott County, every city in Scott County is a winner. Ramsey, every single city. Anoka, every single city. Carver, every single city. Dakota, six cities pay in. Washington, all but one pay, or all are winners except for a place called Oak Park Heights, which I don't even know where that is. But in Hennepin, members, this is where Hennepin is where the whole game goes down. That's where the whole game goes down. You can add up those other few little cities, and it equates to nothing. In Hennepin, there's 33 losers, and that's where like all the money is coming from. So yes, as a whole, Hennepin gives out to the other counties, but if you actually delve into Hennepin and look at the 46 cities of Hennepin, there's just some of us helping the whole rest of the state. And you know, I think, honestly, we're cognizant, Mr. Chair, that we're outnumbered. And so I would have loved to heard that 1971 debate, because it would have been easy. We grandfather in Minneapolis and St. Paul so that they'll all vote for it. You know, they don't have to have their downtowns counted. And then the other 130 legislators can just gang up on a few areas. And that's exactly how it's played out now. So we've come 40 years later, and everybody who grew is paying for everybody else. And we're not, I don't think Representative Defke and I and Representative Anderson, I don't think we're, you know, we get that we don't have the votes to, you know, undo this program for all time. But I think we're just hoping that there could be some recognition that, it could get better. It could, you know, it clearly the numbers show that the disparity between rich and poor would be worse without this program. Richer cities would be richer, poorer cities would be poor. Bloomington would absolutely be significantly better off if this program didn't win. But, I mean, to say that, you know, we're going to have to keep having retail go into fiscal disparities, I mean, you just can't look at this report. And I've read the whole big one and not argue that maybe there's a time that those come out of there. They're losing. We're losing on those big time. And so, I just hope people can open their minds a little bit to what would be some legitimate reforms within this. You know, some of the cities that are getting checks from all of our cities might get bigger checks if we actually had a need formula. Some might get less. But, I mean, to say, you know, 40% is the right number and, oh, we shouldn't count downtown Minneapolis and St. Paul, well, maybe give us all a local option sales tax. How about that? Let us all start taxing all of you as you come across our borders. You know, I don't know. But, I mean, I do think as the chair, Mr. Chair, I couldn't succeed because my side of the aisle wasn't going there. But maybe you can. I don't know. But I do think the question I really have for this study is, you know, and there weren't recommendations, but can you flesh out the retail issue a little bit more for cities? I really think people need to understand what retail is doing, and did the study look at tax increment financing on top of it? I mean, as far as I could tell, it was silent all that on that, and yet most of us who have these big facilities, mine, I'd have to look up everybody else, it's in a tax increment finance district on top of it, so it doesn't even pay property taxes locally. So we're really getting the short end of the stick, and I think Southdale was originally in one. I don't know if it's expired, but you know, then people come along and try to extend them so we can never get a dime out of the facilities. But
Representative Chesky, can I have that note back?
Yeah. Well, and Mr. Chair, you know, but I mean, we're kidding, but the public should know. I mean, the people of Bloomington I represent should know that the chair is carrying a bill to allow the Mall of America to not pay taxes for 25 more years. It'll be over 60 years if that bill passes. And instead, my constituents are paying that facility a subsidy every day. So, I mean, this is what tax increment financing does. It's a hidden tax increase on the people who live there to benefit of development. And so, you know, that, I think, is a key thing that we could all agree on, Mr. Chair, that this study is showing us that if there's anything that's not probably the best place to be handing out subsidies, it's retail.
Thank you, Representative Lancheski. And I'd like to get to Depke and Loeffler here, and we do need to wrap it up here. Thank you, Representative Lancheski. Mr. Michael, what's the official position of this committee regarding fiscal disparities?
Don't ever change that.
Okay, Representative Depke. Yeah.
This is going to be just real quick. One of the things that you didn't have in your study was the impact of water on a district. I represent 11 towns around Lake Minnetonka. If you add up all of our fiscal disparities, we are second only to Bloomington in the state. But we also are the home of Lake Minnetonka, which attracts 250,000 visitors every year, and that we are absorbing in our area. So when you talk about rural versus, you know, activities or whatever, commercial, industrial, what about water? We're a state of 10,000 lakes. Lake Minnetonka is one of the largest inland lakes and occupies well over 30% of the area of my district. How is that?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Lance, I'm sorry.
In terms of the impact of the tourist attraction from the water or the provision, I need to clarify.
Well, I mean, in terms of how you are looking at the fiscal disparity, we don't receive any. We give out my residents on your. If we did without fiscal disparities, they would greatly be happy. They'd be thrilled to get that. But we do have the expense of the lakes, because lake property is taxed at a much higher rate, but yet we are home to one of the largest freshwater lakes in the country, and we get 250,000 residents a year that use our bike trails, that use our lakes and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so we are definitely dearly paying to subsidize that as well. So
right.
Just wanted
right.
to let you know that it's not just about retailers.
Mr. Lance.
Mr. Chairman,
very brief, please. We're going to go.
Okay. Yeah, and this speaks to the complexity of the needs factor or the overburden factor. And we did not look specifically at lake communities in our analysis, but that was, you know, it just speaks to how complex the need piece would be in terms of factoring in non-residents, you know, visitors, what the impact is there. And again, in our fiscal analyses elsewhere, you know, that may come into play depending on the jurisdiction, and to quantify those costs, you know, what are those additional costs and the types of other land uses that support the tourist industry within that jurisdiction, what does it cost the local, you know, the local government to provide those services and maintain an adequate level of service.
Thank you. I just wanted to make that point. because that is very important. We're number two guys.
And we'll wrap up very briefly, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm just hoping that our guests will be able to break out some data on what part of the pool is inflation versus what is new development, or at least inflation of that 1971 base, because my understanding is that the values of commercial industrial just through inflation have increased like 4 or 5 fold, and so, you know, maybe that's another issue we need to look at, is how much is true growth sharing from new development versus what's just the impact of time.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler, and thank you, members, for your work today, and staff. Good government all the time. We are adjourned.